Welcome to Gorgeous Reads on Radio Gorgeous. On the gorgeous sofa, as it were, today, which has been moved to Faber temporarily, we have Kate Griffin, author of Kitty Peck and the Daughter of Sorrow, which is the third in her series of Kitty Peck mysteries. Welcome, Kate Griffin.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Okay, so all of these are standalone mysteries.
They are.
Which is really nice when you have a series. I hate it when I feel left out.
Yes. No, I'm conscious of that.
Yes. However, it did make me very eager to read the first two.
Good. That's how it should be. The kind that what I was aiming at is each book stands alone. So if you've come to it new, you can probably read them in any order. It's probably best to read them in the order in which they were written, obviously. But each one is a standalone mystery or crime story set in the East End of London at the back end of the Victorian era. Everyone has its own plot. Each one of them has a kind of a very tight narrative that hopefully leaves the reader satisfied. But, and I hate this term, there is a sort of overarching narrative that links all three together. And a kind of a mystery that will finally, which I'm writing now in the fourth and final one in the series. I'm writing that now, and the overarching mystery will be revealed.
Fantastic.
In that one.
Okay. So, and yes, as you say, these are the these adventures take place at the back end of the Victorian era. I would say. And they take you through the sort of underbelly of Victorian London with all its gritty glamour of the music halls, all the gaslit pomp and circumstance, and the filth and squalor.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you called it gritty glamour, because it is squalid, it is depraved, it's awful. These people live horrible, rough, very, very poor lives. And yet somebody said to me that it's kind of like beautifully gruesome in a way. Mm-hmm. The lives that they live is beautifully gruesome. And I'm really glad that you picked up on that, because I think there is something about the British music hall, the music hall really, which is desperately seedy. It was a really hard life for music hall performers in the 19th century. But it was full of kind of tarnished, rusted sequins. It was the limelight at the front of these stages, which was vicious and deadly, but it gave people an incredible glow and an incredible brilliance when they were up on stage. So it was smelly, it was sordid, it was dirty, it was tattered. It was ragtag gypsy time, but it had a kind of a surface seedy glamour, which I'm really glad you picked up on, and that hopefully is in the books.
Yes, and that created the magic. Really did create the magic and lit up the lives of squalor.
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely, yeah. And that's what I'm following, really. So my main character, Kitty Peck, is a young girl who has, by default, inherited three music halls in Limehouse in Victorian London. And she is sort of surrounded by various secrets of varying degrees of magnitude and horror, which gradually, as she kind of works her way to a position of more power within the music halls, but ironically within less power in her own life, begins to unravel around her. So that's
all right. I'm going to draw some parallels about Kitty and her story. First of all, she reminded me of a little Becky Sharp from the gutter.
You've just hit my absolute favourite book. Did somebody tell you that?
No.
Vanity Fair is my... If I was ever on... I won't ever be, but if I was ever on Desert Islands, Desert Island Discs, Vanity Fair would be the book that I would take with me, because I read that when I was 12 years old and it made such an impression on me, because it was a Georgian heroine, really, I suppose.
Little Georgian feminist.
Yeah, absolutely. And she was kind of in control of her own life. She knew exactly what she wanted. She saw what she wanted. She was going to get it. And there's a line where I think Thackeray says, you know, she was small with sandy hair and large green eyes. And that was me when I was sort of 11, 12. And I thought, he's writing about me. But more than anything else, you know, she was a strong female character. She wasn't one of those dreadful Victorian wimpy characters who... I love Jane Eyre, but everything happens to her, you know, and she never fights. Well, she does fight back, but she's not in control, you know, whereas Becky is. And also Becky's on the kind of seedy fringe of society as well, you know, but she tells the truth. What I love about Becky all the way through, and which is what Kitty always does, she's true to herself and she always tells the truth. She tells it like she sees it, and if something isn't scented with roses and violets, she doesn't hold back from letting people know.
Exactly, yes. So she's... okay, now I'm going to make another parallel. Yeah. She's sort of like a teen mogul. She's like a Taylor Swift of her time.
That's right, yes.
But and she's a very young woman. Mm-hmm. And she's in charge of this
empire.
Yes, a criminal empire.
As it transpires. And then she sort of, she's, because of that, she becomes isolated.
Yes, yeah.
With power comes jealousy, yeah. Rivalry. She's isolated. She also realizes, despite the perceived power that she has, she's a cog in a very organized crime wheel.
Yeah. And I think that comes as quite a shock to her, because I think in the first book, she's quite naive and she's very determined to make her own way and everything. And she's fearless. The thing about Kitty is she's fearless. In the first book, she's tested as to whether or not she's worthy of becoming the successor to Lady Ginger, the fearsome woman who owns these musicals. And Lady Ginger tests her by putting her up in a cage, a gilded cage, in one of her musicals to sing and perform acrobatic tricks night after night. And the thing is that she will never have a net beneath her. That's why people go. There's never a net, so if she falls... And it was true that in the Victorian era, what people wanted to see was, you know, it was salacious failure. You know, the thought of a young, fragile 17-year-old girl dressed with little wings on her back twirling above a musical 70 foot up, if she fell, although it would be horrific, that was what they were secretly there for. And so this is how she's tested.
The thrill of live theatre.
The thrill, absolutely, but taken to the nth degree, because life was cheap in the East End. And, you know, if she fell, she fell. It was kind of like a terrible thing. And the next day they'd go and see the next amazing act doing stuff. So I wanted to, in the first book, she's got this fearlessness, which is why she becomes this criminal baron indirectly. But as the books have gone on, that fearlessness is being gradually chipped away. The kind of core of her, I wanted to make it clear that the core of her, that kind of amazing spirit that I feel she has, I kind of feel quite protective of her, actually, but it's slowly being chipped away. And by the end of this book, it's just beginning to kind of like come back again.
Her confidence is knocked people around her
betray
get
her.
Knocked or betrayed, and she, you know,
or hurt, or
like anyone else who rises to fame as a teenager, you see who your real friends are.
Absolutely, yeah.
But being friends with her comes at a cost as well.
Comes at a cost to all of her closest friends, particularly her friend Luca. Who, actually, when I first started writing these books, I saw them as kind of like an inverse Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. So Kitty, although she's very bright, she's actually kind of amazingly bright. She's kind of weirdly bright. She's got a photographic memory. I mean, these are all wonderful Victorian Sherlock Holmesian tropes that you can play with, which I have done very consciously. But so she's all kind of heart and vigour and strength and fearlessness. And her partner in crime, as it were, her partner in fighting crime, although it's quite unclear as to really which side they're always on, is Luca, who's an Italian-born scene painter who works in the halls with her. And he is all intellect. He's kind of quite calm, he's quite cool, he's quite collected, he's quite introverted.
Very sensitive,
very artistic. I mean, he's fascinated by the great artists, you know. He's gay as well. So the pair of them have a kind of a bond. They're almost like a brother and sister, because Kitty also has a brother, Joey, who, you know, who has let her down. I don't like to say too much, but that's kind of another dynamic to the relationship.
It's also interesting. Is it the same in the two previous books, where every scene everything, the adventure is told entirely through Kitty's eyes.
Yeah.
So we only know what Kitty knows.
Yeah.
But as you say, luckily, she's very quick-witted and intuitive. And while she can be fooled, she's not fooled for long.
No. But we always see events for the first time through Kitty's eyes. So the narrative is always... It's a tricksy narrative, really, because Kitty can be, and quite often is, wrong. Although, as you say, she's got the wits to kind of think, hang on, that didn't make sense, or that doesn't, two and two doesn't make four here, hello. So, but it's quite interesting doing everything through her point of view, because it's told through first person, in quite a strong, I would think, London idiom in some ways. She has a very particular, it's a Cockney voice, really. It's a sharp, which is again quite Becky Sharp, I think. It's a strong Cockney idiom, and she has a very kind of florid turn of phrase, which actually is based very much on my family, who are a Cockney family originally from Limehouse in the East End, and which has all seeped into this kind of the, you know, the kind of this mixing pot here. It's drawn from so many different things.
And she is very, I love, because you've sort of seamlessly drawn upon her music hall past, because someone who was born, say, higher than she was, wouldn't know to use her sexuality, wouldn't know to use all the costumes that she uses. You know, yeah. She uses her appearance. She knows appearances.
She plays
a
role
yes.
very easily.
Yes, she uses that whole thing in her life. One more parallel I want to ask you about.
Oh, God, and this is because you're spot on.
Yeah,
exactly. Eerie.
Well, I was wondering if she was going to be a bit like Walter White from Breaking Bad as well. And and sort of, is she going to be corrupted by the power she wields and by the violence that she metes out because she deems it necessary to protect the people she loves?
I don't really like to give too much away, actually, because I am writing the last bit now. And she could go one of two ways. She could be so corrupted that the kind of vengeance she wreaks is so terrible that, you know, she becomes almost like a female Jack the Ripper figure. But she won't, I don't think.
You're too protective.
I'm too protective. I couldn't do that to her. But it is a question sometimes, because Lady Ginger, who... I don't know how much to give away, but Lady Ginger was completely corrupted, who is Kitty's predecessor, this elderly harridan figure who is addicted to opium to numb the pain, but it's not just the physical pain because she's dying of cancer, but it's actually the pain of her past and the things she's had to do to get to this point. And she sees Kitty as a tool to make things right. But Kitty occasionally realises that Lady Ginger chose her for a very specific reason. And when she looks in the mirror sometimes, she realises that the two of them, although they're very different, they share a bond of some sort. And that is a worry to her.
Mm-hmm. And like Lady Ginger, she also turns to opium to sort of... because she's under a lot of pressure, but... also,
well,
to
she did
escape
a very terrible thing.
Yeah, to escape the responsibility is what I was going to say.
Absolutely, yeah. She did,
like other addict.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it was, you know, opium was cheap, and also opium in the East End of London was a real. You know, again, this is going back to those whole tropes of the kind.
It was
of
in their purview. It was like normal.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it was kind of so the East End of London, particularly Limehouse, as well, the world washed up on, you know, Britain's shores. And that was the riches of the world, and it was also the evils of the world. And opium, you know, in the 19th century, Britain really strangled China, and the opium trade flourished because of our corruption, really, and what we did. And Limehouse was a fulcrum of that. And so it would be absolutely right that Lady Ginger, as a crime lord operating in the East End, would absolutely know about opium dens and opium parlours. In fact, everyone would know about them. My own grandmother... lived in, well, she was born in St Anne Street in the East End, which is kind of near one of those beautiful churches, one of those wonderful Hawksmoor churches. It's in the shadow of one of the great Hawksmoor churches, St Anne's Church. Beautiful, Georgian, elegant building. St Anne Street actually crouches like a sort of a dirty alleyway in the shadow of that church, and it still does. And they were poor. They were her family were originally, her parents and grandparents were Irish immigrants and Scottish immigrants down to this country. They lived hugger-mugger. There were, I think it was 7 children living in this house. The people who lived in the house next door ran a laundry, and they were a Chinese family. And there were Jewish people living on the other side of the street, and they all lived together in these tiny, very... because they were all immigrants, they'd all washed up. But the thing my grandmother always was, like, really very straight on was that everybody got on. Everyone helped each other. They were dirt poor, but, you know, when a family next door was in trouble, didn't matter whether it was the Chinese family who hardly spoke English or the sort of Jewish family who ran the bakery across the road, they were all in it together. And after, I think I find that, and I hope that comes through in the books as well, that melting pot of faiths and kind of like feeling and nationalities, and it doesn't really flicker on anybody's radar that anybody is different. They are just all part of this climbing, seething mass of people who are trying to kind of scrabble on and do well. And I got that very strongly from my grandmother. We've gone off the point there.
No, but actually, I was going to lead to that. And I was going to ask you, because I just, for the very first time, went to Wilton's Music Hall the other day, and I'm going to a party there next week.
Fabulous.
So, yeah, Wilford.
Oh, how fabulous.
Exactly, and saw this incredible show, Les Enfants Terribles, who are totally playing on the Victorian, puppetry.
Is it the Cocteau?
It's a bunch of short stories, sort of Roald Dahl-ish. Quite wonderful, if you have a chance.
Yeah,
yes, you would.
Anything at Wilton's Music Hall is worth going to.
Yeah, but the atmosphere has been preserved.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, funnily enough, Wilton's Music Hall was one of the reasons, another one of the reasons why I started writing these books. In my, I work part-time for a heritage charity. The charity is called SPAB, the Society for the Protection of Ancient Buildings, and it's the oldest heritage charity in Britain. And it was set up by William Morris. And we're small, but we're quite practical. And our whole point of being is about the fabric of the building and making sure that as much of the original fabric is retained when people work on a building or repair a building. We never say restore, because that suggests you're putting something back that wasn't there originally. It's all quite philosophical. But we helped Wilton's when they were doing their big repair project, and they've kind of come to the end of that over the last 2 years, but it's been a sort of a 8, 10, 9 year project. And I went there one day with a party of architects and surveyors, right back in the early days. And it was hard hat time, and it was just full of pigeon shit and acro props and holes in the wall. And it was, you know, it was a kind of a sad place in some ways. And all these really professional architectural people going around, they were sort of tapping the walls for woodwork, and they were looking. And I wasn't. I was just standing there staring at the stage. And it was like one of those moments where you just have it was an absolute epiphany for me. I just stood there thinking, inhaling the atmosphere and thinking about the people who'd been there, the people who'd been on that stage, the performers, the famous musical performers, George Laybourne, who's Champagne Charlie. Probably people don't, but that name probably doesn't mean a lot to people now, but he was one of the great draws of the Victorian era. He was, you know, people would sell their grannies to go and see Champagne Charlie or George Laybourne on stage. He was a Lyon comique, was the name of that kind of performer, which meant that they were kind of like a comic. It was like a lion, absolutely, a comical lion, like a great man with a great voice and kind of great bluster and bravado. And just the thought of him being there, and then some of the women who'd been there, like Mari Lloyd, and you know, just amazing to think that people who I was fascinated by, because I am fascinated by musical, had stood on that stage and kind of like given their best to the rabble of the East End, probably including people I was related to, you know.
And I wanted to ask you about that, because you are a true Cockney, despite having left.
Well, you know, to be a true Cockney, you don't come from the East End these days. A true Cockney had to be born within the sound of Bow Bells, and that is Bow in Cheapside. And so I was born in Bart's Hospital, pretty much, you know, 100 yards away from Bow in Cheapside. So I am a true born, you know, right back to year dot whenever this started, a true born Cockney.
But when your grandmother was telling you these tales, I mean, actually a lot of Victorian Limehouse still existed.
Yeah.
What do you think now? I love living in London, where we live with our city, like the Tower of London. Like, I can go to the Tower of London. I mean, it's amazing.
If I could be locked in there overnight, just to kind of like
creep around and scare myself silly.
Well, yeah, but it's that inhaling the atmosphere thing. You know, that kind of, I just want to be there and just kind of, not with hundreds of other people. You know, I just want to kind of be there in a little private moment. Not because I think I shouldn't be there, but because I just like to experience it just for a moment, you know, by myself.
So what do you feel like? I mean, especially in our lifetime, the East End, more than anything else, is transformed.
Oh, it's transformed. Yeah. Well, my grandparents moved to Bermondsey after they got married, and that was in about, I suppose it was just after the war, it was about 1918. And then they went up in the world and went to Islington. So my mum was born in Islington, and she had a lot of brothers and sisters. And they've made the great, as a family, as a sort of a Cockney family, they've what you call the great Cockney migration. They've all gone out to Essex and Hertfordshire. So there is hardly anyone left now. I feel I'm like holding the standard for my family, and that I work in the East End. I work in Spitalfields. And I'm writing about the East End, and I'm keeping my grandmothers...
You're keeping it alive.
I'm keeping them alive, but I do go to those streets for research, and it is not for the research as such, like to inform the narrative or the plot, but it's just so that I kind of see road names, and I kind of feel the street layout, and I feel what it would have been like. And even though, as you say, it's now completely changed, you know, even the road where my grandparents, you know, St. Anne Street, that is... You know, been shishied up amazingly, you can tell. But you can see that the roots of it were not that much, but it is now pretty nice. But just to kind of be there, you can just see through that patina of modernisation and money that's come, because, you know, Canary Wharf is shining at the end of St Anne Street now. But you can see through that, and you can feel the original street plan, and you can feel the original, really strongly feel the original soul of that area, I think. It's constantly fascinating to me. Just walking around there is just, I'd recommend it to anyone, because there are some great pubs there as well.
Excellent. Kate Griffin, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, yeah, it's been fantastic. I've loved chatting. Thank you for the Betty Sharp thing.